Oh, thank you. Aloha. Thank you. Mahalo. That's beautiful. Thank you. Aloha. It's wonderful to be with you tonight. And that has nothing to do with the fact that we left 38 degrees and 3 inches of snow on Sunday in Tacoma. So, but besides that, it's great to be with you. Good to see former students and other alumni and to meet those of you that I haven't met before, and many of you are parents of current students, and if I haven't had a chance to meet you yet, I hope that I'll get that chance afterwards. And as Ron mentioned, I'll be sharing some remarks tonight, but I hope that this will be informal enough that as I'm talking, if you have a question about something I'm addressing, just let me know. If you run out of food and you need to get some more food, don't feel like you need to wait until I'm done. But when I am done, then I would like to save some time for some questions. If you have questions about the material that I cover tonight or other things that you would like us to talk about tonight, I'd be happy to do that as well. This evening, what I'd like to do is engage you in an intellectual conversation about two things that are important to me and I believe are very important to Puget Sound. That is student learning and contemporary Asia. And I have felt that a great vehicle for doing this is the university's unique Pacific Rim Asia Study Travel Program, what we have affectionately come to call PAC-RIM. Like some of our students, I first learned of Puget Sound about 20 years ago through the reputation of this signature program. Puget Sound now sponsors study abroad in over 50 countries. But there's only one program, PAC-RIM, of this type that is offered by any institution of higher learning. And as Ron mentioned, typically these are we have usually about 20 to 25 students that spend 8 months in an academic sojourn through Asia. They complete 8 courses on a variety of programs, a variety of subjects. This time around, it ranged from a paleontology course in Mongolia and ecotourism in the Himalayas, to an art history course in Cambodia and India, as well as my own course on comparative nationalism in Vietnam and China. PAC-RIM was launched, see if I can get this to work, yes. PAC-RIM was launched in 1973 by Professor Bob Albertson, and where's Clinton at? He said he remembered, so some of the others of you maybe remember Bob Albertson. And who's launched this program in 1973. And since that time, over 350 students on 12 different trips have been introduced to Asia. And these are just some of the groups that have done so. I did want to mention, if I could, just at the beginning, in sadness, the sad news we learned this past week of the tragic climbing death of Travis Lazote. Some of you may have known Travis. He was involved with Outward Bound, was in a climb in the Patagonias of Argentina, and fell, an ice bridge broke and collapsed. This was just last week, so we will certainly miss Travis. This past December, Ron, Mary, and I had the opportunity to meet up with the current PAC-RIM group in China and Vietnam. And I thought a nice way to start our conversation about Asia and student learning at Puget Sound would be to discuss my own report from the RIM, as it were. What I sought to teach, and I think probably more importantly, what I learned as part of this remarkable academic sojourn through Asia. I've been traveling regularly in Asia since 1977. I love the region, I love its cultures, I love its peoples, I particularly love its foods. And since the early 1980s, I've been a serious student of the politics of Asia. As Ron mentioned, my own research is in the field of comparative political economy. I teach general courses on democracy and authoritarianism, development, comparative communism. I have a theory course on Adam Smith and Karl Marx, and several courses on Asia that some of you who are here tonight have taken. I teach a course on Japanese political economy, another one on Chinese political economy, and a course on Asian political systems. Knowing that the PAC-RIM group would be traveling to China and Vietnam, before the PAC-RIM group left, I proposed teaching a course on Confucianism, colonialism, and communism in these two remaining communist, well, at least by name, communist countries. And so we pitched this idea to our two host institutions in Fuzhou, China, in southern China, and to our host campus in Hanoi, Vietnam. And we were told politely but firmly by both campuses that we would not teach a course about communism on their campuses. So I changed the name of the course to Comparative Nationalism in China and Vietnam, and then I taught a course on Confucianism, colonialism, and communism. Permit me to give you a 5-minute overview of the course. I think it worked quite well. PNG 388, as the course was numbered, over the course of 4 weeks, sought to systematically compare China and Vietnam's extraordinarily painful experiences with nationalism. Both pre-modern Chinese and Vietnamese societies were dominated by this social philosophy that we know as Confucianism. It informed Chinese and Vietnamese familial, social, and political organization for over 2,000 years. This is a picture of two different temples, one in China and one in Vietnam. And this is a picture of a 1,000-year-old Confucian temple in Hanoi, Vietnam, where we had one of our field trips. The institutions of Confucianism gave these societies a remarkable degree of stability because they afforded a degree of social and political mobility and what we call in political science the capacity for the circulation of elites. We see this in the practices that Confucianism promoted, such as equal inheritance, where all of the male offspring in a family would inherit equally the wealth of the family. The Chinese refer to this as fu bu guo san dai, that the wealth never goes beyond the second generation or the third generation because by then it is dispersed sufficiently. And because of this, it meant that there was not a concentration of wealth because of that equal inheritance. We also see this in the Confucian examination system. As some of you may know, it was a meritocratic system which allowed, at least in principle, for anyone that was able to pass the exams to move their way up through not just the education and political system, but also move their way up into the social system and to come to the gentry class, which allowed for significant social mobility. And we also saw this in the mandate of heaven, which was this Confucian norm for legitimizing the rule of an emperor. And so if there was floods or famines or droughts or civil unrest, if it got to a critical point, this could be justification for overthrowing the emperor. And so out with the bad and in with the new, and this allowed for a circulation of dynasties, which allowed the system to remain in place even as the elite, at least to some degree, circulated through that system. But I argued in the course that Confucianism became so deeply entrenched in both societies that each was ill-prepared to deal with the challenges of Western imperialism. Both China and Vietnam were quickly overrun, particularly by the 19th century, and dominated by Western colonial powers. Here is a picture of us in front of the Meiyuan prison in Fuzhou, China, which was connected to the British consulate. And so any of the Chinese who resisted the British incursions could be locked up here in the Meiyuan prison. This is the infamous Hanoi Hilton, which got its start as a French colonial prison for jailing those involved with the Vietnamese resistance movement. Inside, in addition to John McCain's flight suit, because this is where John McCain spent time as well, they also had a French-era guillotine, complete with one basket for the body and another basket for the head. As these societies continued to struggle, nationalists did begin to emerge, and probably the most significant of these early nationalists in China and Vietnam was Hawaii's own Sun Yat-sen. As you may know, Sun Yat-sen, who's often considered the George Washington of China, migrated to Hawaii. He attended both the Iolani and Punahou schools. And this is actually a birth certificate, a fake birth certificate, showing that Sun Yat-sen was born here in Hawaii. He actually was not. But he was very frustrated as he looked at this Confucian system that he felt had tied China down for thousands of years. He complained that this Confucian Chinese civilization was like a rope of sand. He said China looked like a nation. It had nearly 5,000 years of continuous history as a civilization, but he said there was no unity. He said if you tried to pick that nation up and wield it as a defense against the predations of imperialism, it crumbled in your hands. And each of those grains of sand, each Chinese family, each Chinese clan, was self-sufficient. He said there was no national loyalty, no sense of national identity, let alone loyalty towards a central government. Sun looked enviously at the powerful sense of nationalism that was emerging in neighboring Meiji Japan, that he argued had spared Japan from the predations of Western imperialism. And it's interesting to note some of the similarities, and this is something I do in one of my courses, some of the similarities between China and Japan at this point. Both China and Japan had Confucian societies. Both China and Japan, from the early 17th century until the middle of the 19th century, had explicit policies of isolationism, sakoku, as the Japanese would refer to this. But both were violently open to the West in the middle of the 19th century. China with the Opium War in 1839, and Japan with the arrival of Admiral Perry in 1853. But there were consequential differences in these two societies and the way in which they employed Confucianism as well. We talked about China already, equal inheritance, this meritocratic exam system that allowed for social mobility, and the mandate of heaven. In Japan, by contrast, there was an inheritance system of primogeniture. So the oldest son would inherit the wealth in the family. This allowed for a concentration of wealth in a group of merchant houses that became financially very powerful by the 19th century. Also, whereas China had this open and mobile class system and the ability to circulate among the classes and to enter the gentry class, in the case of the Japanese, the highest class, the samurai class, was completely sealed off so that those below, these wealthy merchants, continued to be despised and couldn't move into the samurai class. And the impoverished samurai, who were becoming increasingly indebted to the merchants, couldn't put down their swords and take up the hoe. It was very difficult for them to even move down in the system. And so this led to what some have called a powder keg, ready for some kind of a change. And then third, you had continuous imperial reign in Japan, which provided a focal point for national unity. These differences brought nationalism to Japan more quickly and effectively. Some would conclude, in fact, too effectively. By the 20th century. Back to Vietnam and China, ultimately, powerful nationalist movements of independence did come to both of these countries. But it took a crucible of decades of devastating wars. Horrendous in the case of China. China experienced nearly 25 years of almost continuous civil war, and then a horrendous conflict with Japan from 1937 to 1945, Japan having acquired its own imperialist proclivities by the 20th century. Vietnam resisted first the French, then the Japanese, then defeated the French in 1954, only to square off against the Americans again for the next 20 years. I show you this next picture, and it's difficult to see, but Professor Hu Nok is standing right here between two of the Pat Rivers. This gentleman is a national cultural treasure in Vietnam. He's 93 years old. He still walks about 5 miles to his small office every day. And he taught He's a renowned Vietnamese scholar, and he taught two lectures to our students, one on Confucianism in Vietnam and one on Vietnamese nationalism. He's an anthropologist by training, but he was particularly well prepared to teach us about nationalism in Vietnam. Professor Hu fought in the Vietnamese resistance movement, first against the French in the 1930s as a youth, then against the Japanese during the Japanese occupation in the 1940s, then against the French in the 1950s, and finally against the Americans in the 1960s, and then went on to learn seven languages, speaks English fluently, and was just a remarkable, delightful man and a remarkable professor. But he's a good representation of this nearly 40 years of continuous war and resistance. And what I argued in my course is that these wars forged a genuine nationalist movement in China and in Vietnam and created modern national identities for the overwhelming majority of Chinese and Vietnamese citizens. The movements were led by heroic nationalist leaders who also happened to be communists and gave to these newly established nation states and communist parties that led them a powerful focus and source of unity and legitimacy. Because of the restrictions on what I could teach in the classroom, this is where the classroom instruction ended. But let me conclude tonight by sharing just some of the things that we learned outside of the classroom. In most ways, I found to be the most important learning environment on Pac Rim. We tried to do three or four field trips each week in the 4 weeks that I was teaching the course, and we had some remarkable experiences. It was obvious as we talked with people and met with people and talked with professors and others, it was obvious that both countries have tried to hang on to the legacies of Mao Zedong, the communist nationalist leader of China, and Ho Chi Minh, the communist nationalist leader of Vietnam. And they did this in an effort to justify their authoritarian communist rule. This is oftentimes referred to as hagiography, this effort to kind of ride on the laurels of some previous leader. And we saw this in the cases of both Vietnam and China. I forgot to mention, but the picture of the building next to Mao Zedong was his mausoleum on Tiananmen Square. The picture was the 30-foot portrait of him on the face of the Gate of Heavenly Peace, also at Tiananmen. And this is one of the many pictures of Ho Chi Minh, and this is his mausoleum where his remains are interred as well. But much of the legitimacy that both of these regimes had gained during this nationalist period were squandered on wrong-headed radical campaigns. And you're familiar, I suspect, many of you, with some of these. China's Great Leap Forward in the 1950s, the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s. In the case of Vietnam, its effort to force the communization of the South after 1975. They also lost legitimacy because of the inherent inefficiencies and weaknesses of socialist command economies. And as this founding legitimacy waned, both of these communist dinosaurs have sought other means to justify and maintain their authoritarian monopoly control in the hands of these communist party states. And what I wanted to do was just mention very briefly four of these tools that these states, and I refer to these as four C's, maybe it'll be a little easier for you to remember, because Ron didn't mention, but there is an exam at the end, even though it's free. Maybe it'll be easier for you to remember these, but I'm happy to. So I'm just going to touch on these four ways in which these authoritarian communist parties have tried to stay in power. But if you want to talk in more detail about any of these or what their contemporary significance is, we can do that. The first of these C's is capitalism. China launched its reform and opening in late 1978. Vietnam launched its version, which they refer to as Doi Moi, some 8 years later in 1986. These liberalization, economic, not political, these economic liberalization measures brought unprecedented prosperity to the masses in both countries in exchange for political quiescence. And that's the social contract. this unspoken social contract of what we refer to oftentimes as performance legitimacy. As long as this party state can continue to deliver economic benefits, then we'll continue to keep our, as the a Chinese friend of mine after Tiananmen said, bico dito, that we'll keep our mouths shut and our heads bowed. But if the economic benefits stop, then all bets are off, some have concluded. Second C, co-optation. The co-optation of the so-called red capitalists. Both the ruling Chinese Communist Party and the Communist Party of Vietnam have welcomed wealthy capitalists into the parties. And the result is you have these so-called red capitalists or communist capitalists. And Marx and Mao and Ho are all rolling in their graves now, wondering how these exploiters, these vampire capitalists, have now become part of the ruling elite. A third C, censorship. Government propaganda is ubiquitous in both of these countries. These pictures, the one on the top is a one-child policy tile propaganda sign in China, and the one on the bottom is one kind of a heroic remembrance of Dien Bien Phu when the Vietnamese defeated the French. But this propaganda is up against this explosion of access to digital information. Hundreds of thousands of cell phones and computers and internet access in both of these countries. And so one of the really interesting puzzles today is, can the efforts by these authoritarian states to resist this free flow of information, including political information, can they overcome this? And sometimes this is referred to as the Great Firewall of China. But some argue that no, the genie's out of the bottle. There's no way that they can hold this back. The latest effort by the Chinese is known as, the Chinese government has referred to it as the Golden Shield. And they have they've started in Shenzhen, this city right outside of Hong Kong, and they've placed over 100,000 closed-circuit cameras on each of the street corners. And they have a staff of thousands who monitor the closed-circuit cameras. They claim, and I think with some justification, this is also to tamp down crime and other problems. But certainly, one of the primary motivations is political, is censorship. A fourth C, when all else fails, surveillance, arrest, torture, and execution are still tools of the state. And we've seen some recent evidence of this. You may have heard there was the family of one of China's leading dissidents, Gao Zhisheng, was just given refugee status in the United States. They fled through Thailand just last week. And to hear her accounts of the way in which her husband has been dealt with by the state is chilling. Very quickly, and I can come back to this if you want the longer story, but I had a first-hand experience with the strong arm of the Chinese state. This was in Fuzhou, China. That morning, coincidentally, we'd been talking about authoritarianism in China. That afternoon, I was walking down to, I can't even remember where I was going, but I was walking through the neighborhood where we were staying. I'd been taking pictures of dozens of these propaganda signs that are everywhere, and I got to this street corner that you can see in the lower picture, and I saw this white with red letters propaganda sign, which is fairly innocuous. It was about how if we're good communists, we'll obey traffic rules. And so I thought, well, this is kind of nice. It's put right on the wall. I'm going to take a picture of it. I snapped the picture. The instant I took the picture, a military policeman dashed across the street, seized my camera, and asked me in Chinese, "What are you doing here?" And so I explained to him that I was a professor and that I had just come to take this picture of the propaganda sign. What I didn't realize is that the naval headquarters were right behind this. And so it would be kind of like someone outside of the CIA, a Chinese, you know, snapping pictures outside of the CIA headquarters in Virginia. And so I was escorted by this individual back to that, you can see a little pillbox there, and I spent the next hour going through interrogation by four levels of the naval security police, in the end, they gave me back my camera and just deleted that one picture. So they were very polite, but it reminded me.
Carl was late for his meeting with me then.
Yes, I had. But I had a good excuse. What's that?
So did you just take it again?
Oh, yeah, so that's right. That's the rest of the story. So the rest of the story. So how did I get the picture? So the very next day, I was on the bus, because I took the bus by here almost every day. And so I was driving on the bus, and I saw it again. I thought, that's it. And no one's going to believe the story unless I take the picture. So I pulled my camera out, took the picture through the window of the bus, and as soon as I did, my face flushed red, and I thought, there could be somebody on this bus that could be, you know, and they could drag me off the bus and they'd take me back there, and now I have a second, but that didn't happen. I got the picture. Yeah, that's right. Who are you working for? No. So I got the picture. But as these, so those are the four C's, ways in which they've stayed in power. But as we look at these, particularly in the case of China, as economic growth slows, the World Bank yesterday said that China, who's been flying at about an 11% growth rate for the last 2.5 centuries, the World Bank is now predicting 6.5% for next year. China itself has said that they need to maintain 8% GNP or GDP growth rate every year just in order to maintain enough employment to keep society stable. They're now saying 6.5%. So as the economic growth slows, it's been very tempting for these communist authoritarian regimes to stir embers of nationalism. We see in authoritarian regimes that nationalism is a very effective substitute for democracy. It's inclusive, it gets people involved, but it's not democratic. Citizens feel a part of the political process, but they have no effectual claim on government. And so nationalism is a very tempting means to deal with this. And we're witnessing increasingly strident forms of nationalist sentiment, particularly in China. Some of this has been promoted and even sponsored by the party state. We can think of the torch politics prior to the Olympics last year. Anti-Japanese riots, which have been stirred up on occasions. Also the anti-Dalai Lama sentiment that came out, particularly after the events of last March. At times, however, this nationalism, even though the state has been sponsoring it, it has spun out of control. We see the Chinese have referred to this movement among the youth as fanqing, or angry youth. We also, you may have seen in the news this last week, a confrontation between an American vessel off the coast of China and three Chinese naval vessels. And some are wondering that if this isn't a way to kind of intentionally stir things up as Barack Obama gets a chance to meet Hu Jintao in April in Europe. Ironically, then, this rope of sand, this Chinese nation state that had too little nationalism and was therefore victimized by Western imperialism, may in fact now have more nationalism than it bargained for or perhaps can even handle. 2009, I think, could be an important watershed for both of these countries, but particularly China. Economic growth, as we've mentioned, which has been the primary source of performance legitimacy, is in steep decline. Political dissent is on the increase. We can talk about Charter 08, or some of you may have seen this really interesting piece in the New York Times last week about the grass mud horse, which is a way for dissidents in China to get around censorship. So political dissent is on the rise. Also, this is a year of ominous anniversaries in China. 60 years ago in 1949 was the founding of the PRC. 50 years ago, the Tibetan rebellion against Chinese rule. This is when the Dalai Lama fled Tibet. And 20 years ago in 1989, of course, was the crushing of the demonstrations in Tiananmen Square. 10 years ago, the crushing of the Falun Gong religious sect. And some are arguing that this confluence of events will make it sorely tempting for the authoritarian party state to step up nationalism as a means of quelling dissent and marshaling support. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on this as well if you'd like to talk about that. This is what I taught on Pac Rim. I'd like to conclude very briefly with four other things that I learned on this remarkable academic sojourn. First, selfishly, Pac Rim is a great experience for the students, but it's just as true, I can now attest, having my first experience to teach on Pac Rim, for the professor. It's a professor's dream come true to teach. I've been teaching about these things for years, but to stand where Mao Zedong stood and talked about the impact of peasant rebellion, to stand where Sun Yat-sen gave a lecture on nationalism, to stand where Ho Chi Minh stood up and announced the independence of Vietnam is a remarkable experience. Students learned something from me, I hope, but what I came to learn was that, more importantly, they learned from each other. Pac Rim, and I would suspect for all of you, when I went to graduate school at UC Berkeley, Chalmers Johnson was my advisor, and the first thing he said to me, the first day I got there, he said, "The best course you'll ever take here is called lunch. And you're going to learn more from your fellow students than you ever learned from any of us." And so this, what I'm going to say now, applies to all of you who had a student experience at Puget Sound, I would submit, but it was perhaps particularly the case in Pac Rim. These students became an ambulatory collection of experts on almost every imaginable topic. And it was remarkably rewarding for me to observe them teach each other. Everything from nuanced explanations of Buddhist statuary and Chinese maritime history to far more obscure topics, beer making in Mongolia, calculating terminal velocity, lyrics to 1980s rock songs, or details of Star Trek episodes. Somebody was an expert on almost everything, and it was great to see them work with each other. This year's Pac Rim group boasts social scientists, humanists, 5 natural science majors, including one who deferred his medical school acceptance so that he could participate on Pac Rim as a 5th-year senior. Third, Ron and Mary Thomas care about Pac Rim and truly care about Puget Sound. They probably have had tougher assignments so far than coming to Asia for Pac Rim, but it meant a great deal that they would take time out of their very busy schedules to spend time with the students, not just on Pac Rim, but Ron's coffee hour with the students in the student-run Diversions Cafe, their attendance at athletic events, and the many other things that Ron and Mary do. This makes a difference. The students know that Ron Tom cares, and that makes a difference. Finally, alumni really care about Pac Rim and truly care about Puget Sound. One of the significant events of our time in China was the celebration of the contributions of the Trimble family, which includes 4 Puget Sound alumni. We had lunch with 2 of those Trimbles today. They live here in Hawaii. And we honored their contributions both to the University of Puget Sound and Huanan Women's College, which was our host in Fuzhou, China. And these contributions include new Trimble halls both in Fuzhou at the campus of Huanan and at Puget Sound. So we're grateful for their financial assistance and the many things that they do to support the university. More significantly, and more generally, the generous and ongoing contributions from literally hundreds of Pac Rim and other Asian Studies alumni made it possible this year for us to provide financial aid for every Pac Rim student with financial need. And so I end my comments by expressing my appreciation to you for what you and the many other alumni and friends and parents of students of Puget Sound have meant and continue to mean both to my career and to our university. Mahalo. And if you have questions or comments, Dave will let us know, I think, when we need to be done, but we have a few minutes where we could take. If you have, I would welcome your comments or suggestions. If you have questions about other aspects of Asia or some of the other things that we did, or about Asian studies or other things that I can address, I'd be happy to. Yes, John.
What's your best thought about the strain in social contract in China? Where do you think it's going to go? Nobody knows where the financial thing is going to go.
Yes, that's a great question. And I have to say that I am bullish on the ability of the party state to hold the course. There was an interesting piece earlier this week in the New York Times talking talking about this, arguing that the party state is, and in part because of its authoritarian capacity to see a problem, not have to worry about earmarks and the Republicans and the Democrats and everything else. Here's a problem. Let's throw $565 billion at it tomorrow. And they can do that, and they did that. And so some are looking at what China has done with its infrastructure projects and saying what they're doing is actually retooling, because they have an industrial structure that's now 20 years old in many cases. And so they're retooling in a way that may allow them to... So economically and strategically, I think they're making the right choices. The rub and the real question is, can society hold together? It took Britain about 150 years to industrialize. It took the United States about half that time. It took Japan about half that time. And now China is trying to industrialize in, less than 15 years, effectively. And whether or not society can handle what Charles Dickens complained about, that Britain survived in 150 years, is really a tough question. But I think they will do it. The party state remains, for most Chinese, because of this combination of censorship and delivering the goods, remains highly popular. The Olympics was a remarkable success from the perspective of the Chinese. And so I think they've still got quite a bit of political capital there. That said, 186,000 demonstrations or social uprisings just last year. And so whether or not that social fabric can make, and the irony here is that now the government is bringing back Confucianism as a solution, right? They're saying to people, self-reliance is a good thing. Obeying the emperor, in this case the party, is a good thing. And so they're drawing on some of these cultural institutions to try to do that.
If the United States moves towards a cap and trade program,
I think it'll be a long time, and some of you probably know more about this than I do, but my sense is, I don't know if you saw, but this last week, the argument they're making, and I think it's perhaps a compelling argument, is that we should not be responsible for all of the production that goes on in our country, because virtually all of it is EOM. It's all heading out of our country. And so you're the ones buying this stuff. If you're going to buy all this stuff, if you want us to produce all this stuff, then you need to take ownership not just of your own carbon emissions, you need to take ownership of a portion of our carbon emissions as well. Now, even in an Obama administration, I don't think that's going to fly. But I think China will be able to effectively make, and for the global environment, tragically, but I think they will effectively be able to make an argument that we need far more lead time to do this. The flip side of that, though, is that a part of this infrastructure investment that China is now making is in green technology. And so they may be able to ride that as well. These have both been good questions. I'd be interested in your opinions as well afterwards if we have time. Yes?
I have a question about how do the social and political situations in China and other parts of Asia affect how they address ecological and conservation problems? For example, like the Baiji, which is the... You can tell everybody
what it is. No, the Baiji?
The Baiji, it's the freshwater dolphin that just went extinct in China.
No, I was not aware of that.
Oh, okay. So. It's the freshwater dolphin that...
Oh, yeah, that's
just
right, that's right.
They sent a whole cruise up to look for it.
And they found none. So I don't know if you could hear what she was saying, but this is, the question of how does this kind of social setting, political setting, affect the attitudes of Chinese or awareness of Chinese or other Asians towards the environment. Just as we can think about a demographic transition in developing societies where it becomes more rational to have less children than more children, that's referred to as the demographic transition. We've seen also in industrializing societies that there is an ecological transition where the benefits of unbridled economic growth or the costs of unbridled economic growth begin to outweigh its benefits and a recognition that, that something needs to change. That awareness is not yet in China. And part of the problem is that the Chinese government has not allowed the emergence of a significant civil society. And so you do have NGOs emerging in the margins, and the government has been more tolerant of NGOs of the ecological variety than they have of the labor or property or political variety. But it's still very nascent in the case of China. I mean, certainly we've seen in Japan how, you know, if you look at Japan in the 1960s compared to Japan today, they made that ecological transition. It's going to be much more difficult for China because they're so dependent on fossil fuels, and the industrialization will continue. And so I think environmentally, China and the world has a tough road ahead of us, unfortunately. Yes?
You mentioned earlier that they need to sustain about 8.5% growth.
Yes. 8% is what they've said, 8%. Yes. Right.
I mean, how sustainable is it? Because even at 6 or 8%, I mean, it's not a linear growth. It's
yes.
It's compounding itself. So at some point, there has to be a breaking point.
That's exactly right. And I think most, and I'm not an economist, I think most economists, if you would ask them in 1985, or in 1995, or in 2005, as someone had said, for the next decade, China is going to experience over 10% per annum increases, as you say, increases in GDP, they would have said this is impossible. There's no way, not just because of the social strains, but there's no way that, that the economy could manage that. They've managed to ride that tiger. Whether they can continue to do that, I think many are grateful to see that kind of throttling back to 8%. Whether that can continue is a great question. At some point, and we've hit on some of these. There are ecological barriers. There are social barriers. There are political barriers as well. So I don't know. The big concern before was inflation. Now the concern is deflation. And
trying to change from an exporting country to a consumer country, so that the factories that are sitting idle, instead of exporting, is for at home consumption.
Yes, that's a great point. And certainly,
they plan to maintain that growth rate, because they are the biggest market.
Yes, it's going to have to be generated by domestic demand. And one of the complaints about this stimulus package that China has rolled out is that it's far more geared still towards the export economy than it is trying to generate domestic demand. But you're right, it's going to have to be, particularly with, you know, India now coming on board with a $2,000 automobile, this Nano. There's no way China's going to be able to depend on the foreign market in the way they have in the past. You know, Japan is recognizing this as well. The domestic consumption is going to have to drive Asian growth in a way that it hasn't in the past. Let's see. Yes? Yes.
It's been a long time since I've heard about Taproot, but I remember in my time, there was plans to go to Indonesia, but that, due to the political situation, that city was canceled. I'm just wondering, what do you guys do in terms of like those countries in Asia that can't go due to geopolitical reasons, or how do you give any force measure?
We just let Ron worry about that. We just send him, and then, you know, the parents get nervous about where we send him. That's Ron's for now. Now, we were very nervous, as you know, with the Mumbai bombings. These happened just weeks, 7 weeks before the students were supposed to be in Mumbai. And so we have a fantastic Office of International Programs. Some of you that have been on study abroad know Jenny Meisberger. And we watched this very carefully. We were, you know, in daily contact after that, trying to figure out what to do. The students were, we had scheduled for them to go to Nepal. After they left India, they're now in India. They just had a private audience with the Dalai Lama last week. They were on homestays with families in Dharamsala, India. They were there and had a chance to meet with the Dalai Lama. The plan was then to take them on to Nepal, but things were a little dicey last year when we were putting things together, so we shifted that. Back in, was it 91, the first Gulf War? They were supposed to go to India, but the State Department said, you don't want to go to a country with a significant Muslim population right now, as we're invading Iraq. And so we shifted gears at the last minute. They went to Taiwan instead. The next group did get to go to Indonesia. So in fact, didn't you guys meet them in? Oh, Malaysia. Sorry, Malaysia, not Indonesia. It was Kuala Lumpur. So it is something that we have to watch very carefully, and probably increasingly that will become more of a factor, not just with PACRIM, but with, there's a lot of challenges with study abroad, and these are things that the budget task force and the president's cabinet has been looking at.
We took students out of Madagascar just 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
Because of the uprising.
Of the coup. Good question.
We have time for one more.
I need to ask the last question. Well, let's get Noah. Noah, go ahead, Noah.
Two more. President.
Okay.
I was curious. Your initial course title kind of suggested to me. I was wondering how much of an argument you made for a Weberian, I guess, connection between Confucianism and communism.
That's a good question. The connection that we often make, the ironic connection for Max Weber, who was this 19th century German sociologist, and Confucianism, is that when Max Weber in the middle of the 19th century looked at China, he said there's no way that Asia is going to be able to develop in the way that Europe has, because Europe had this Protestant asceticism, and that gave them a spirit of capitalism. And he said that Confucianism, because Confucius despised merchants, they were the lowest class. When I write the four Confucian classes on the board for my students, we put, the scholar gentries are the highest class in Confucian societies. Next come the artisans and craftsmen, because they produce something of, or the peasants are next, they produce the rice that feeds the scholars. The next class are the artisans, because at least they do something productive. And then way down at the bottom, we put the merchants. Sorry, business, we had several business majors over here, sorry about that. They put the merchants, because Confucius said they don't do anything. They're usurers. They're harmful to society. And Max Weber looked at that and said, there's no way a Confucian society is going to be able to develop. So one of the interesting puzzles for those of us that study Asian political economy is to ask ourselves, well, did that development come in spite of Confucianism? Or was it because of Confucianism? Or was Marx right? Culture doesn't matter anyway. So, but we can talk more about that afterwards. No. Ron, go ahead.
Real quick, on the nationalism.
Yes.
I'm going back to Sun Yat-sen and the Rope of Sand.
Yes, yes.
What are the fibers that have connected the grains?
Yes.
What is nationalism for China?
Yes.
How can it be invoked? Is there enough of a sense of general consensus about what nationalism might be in China?
That's a great question, and I think it's still an open question. Certainly, the communists would like to claim that what has brought us together was communism. I made the argument that it was this anti-colonial nationalism, that they really didn't have a sense of what China was as a nation.
But it's not.
So it's really defined in the negative, which Benedict Anderson and others who study nationalism would argue that's not surprising that that's the case. But it really does raise the question, what is a 21st century nationalism in China? And is this a positive force, or is it a negative force? And I think a lot of the recent research has pointed to the fact that China, the regime, the party state, has to be very nervous about wielding this rope now, because we've seen in several cases in some of this anti-Japanese demonstrations that it's really gotten out of control. And this kind of grassroots political involvement, I think the regime worries, can quickly turn from one of pro-China to anti-government. And so they're not really sure how to handle this right now. Thanks, you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carl, for making the trip and for the wonderful presentation and the engaging dialogue. It's great, and thank you all very much again for coming out tonight. I noticed a couple people here had cameras and were taking pictures. We will need to speak with you on your way out. For the last word this evening, I want to introduce your regional co-chair, Keikoa Bofra. Thank you, Dave. It's really exciting tonight to see a lot of new faces this evening. I've been attending these events for the past 5 years or so, and I used to know everyone in the room, but tonight it's really exciting to see a lot of new faces, a lot of new energy, which means a lot of opportunities for you to volunteer with the Hawaii region. I joined the Alumni Council, I was at a term from 2005 to 2008, and it was an exciting time for us because we were going through a transformation. We had, when I originally joined, we had 24 positions on the council, and we had to reach out to, you know, thousands of alumni throughout the nation, throughout the world. And during the middle of my term, we kind of scratched our heads and said, this is kind of tough, this is kind of difficult, maybe we should restructure and so we can reach out to more of our alumni, to the untouched alumni. So as President Thomas referenced to the back of the room, we have a chart of the new structure, and what we did was we created 12 new committees. We still have the executive level, they're the heads of the committee, and under the committee are just positions for all the alumni to see what you're interested in and be a part of the committee and help us to reach out to all of our fellow classmates. You know, because each of us, I'm class of 95, some of the newer alumni, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to know your friends and whatnot. So we're going to reach out, you know, we're asking for your help. You know, you keep in contact with, you know, 10 of your closest people. And by doing this, we can reach out and help each other. And my focus, my passion is we have a committee called Regional Clubs, and we've broken it out between East Coast and West Coast in the nation. And myself and Amy Takahashi, who couldn't be here this evening, we're kind of heading up the Hawaii region, and the goal in the next couple months is to try to get in contact with each of you, and you know, this isn't a lifelong commitment or anything, you know, just asking for your assistance to reach out to who you talk to, and maybe we're going to create like a database so we can get in contact with all of you, and then just reconnect to the university. And instead of getting together once a year at these events and, you know, rekindling friendships, you know, we want to, ways that we can help, we can be mentors to new graduates who are, maybe want to come back to Hawaii. So, you know, we have each of you in different fields who they can reach out if they're interested in and maybe talk to before they can do some networking before they graduate and whatnot. So these are ways where you can get involved and help out. And then, you know, we also want to plan regional activities other than the formal ones this evening. Maybe we'll, in the summer, we'll do a barbecue or a potluck at Alamana Beach Park. And, you know, just stay connected, keep in touch, you know, because we all have, we all know somebody in different fields, and we can network. You know, this is, you know, Puget Sound is a, you know, we all have a special place for, you know, Puget Sound in each of us. And so I think this helps us, you know, we can create this strong network and reach out to each other. And then we want the current students, by doing this, we can give the current students the experience that we had. And I think that's why we're all in this room. So I think if you're interested in, which I know you all are, if we can get maybe your contact information on the way out. And Colleen mentioned to me logger.net. We're accessible. Logger.net. Okay, so that's another way to China. We can get your information, and we also have, if you're on Gmail, HawaiiLoggers@gmail.com. And you know, once again, thank you for coming this evening. It's great to see so many new faces. If I haven't met you yet, I'm going to hang around and try to meet each of you. Thank you, Dr. Carl Fields, for your presentation. That was awesome. And as always, President Thomas, for visiting us this year. And wish you the best of luck for the rest of the year. And enjoy the rest of the evening. The evening's not done, so continue to mingle and reconnect. Thank you very much.
I'm going to take a look at the Can you text that?